From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Georgia has the reprehensible distinction as the state with the second highest number of documented lynchings. A 2015 report by the Equal Justice Initiative found nearly 600 cases in the state. A memorial opened earlier this year in Montgomery, Alabama, to honor lynching victims. For some people, it is the first exposure to this ugly history. Others are still healing from the toll racial violence took on their families. This Friday, the Episcopal Diocese of Atlanta and the Absalom Jones Center for Racial Healing will remember Georgia's 600-plus lynching victims. Catherine Meeks joins me to talk about the event. She's executive director at Absalom Jones Center for Racial Healing, and welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. Historian Anthony Pitch is joining us from D.C. He wrote the book, The Last Lynching, How a Gruesome Murder Rocked a Small Georgia Town. Hello, Anthony.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Catherine, I'm going to start with you because your organization decided to memorialize these victims. Why?
Well, our job is to talk about racial healing, and I'm totally convinced that the only way we can actually have real healing is if we pay attention to all pieces of the history. And we've done such a good job of trying to deny that lynching happened and kind of wanting to skip over it. We talk about slavery and then we go to Jim Crow or we go somewhere else and we think we can skip lynching and we can't because that's just a piece of history that has to be appropriated some kind of way. And so that's what we're trying to do.
So how will you do it? How will you memorialize these victims?
Well, we have a memorial service and we remember them and then we call their names and then we are erecting a marker with all of their names on it. And this time the marker will be placed on our property so that we will have them every day. We will pass by that marker and people coming into our building will pass by it and we will be able to continue to remember them, even though we will have just had that program on Friday.
Among those marked are going to be those killed in 1946. This was an African-American couple, two African-American couples at Moores Ford Bridge in Walton County. This is something, Anthony, you wrote a book about. What happened?
Well, on the 25th of July, 1946, a white farmer was taking back a man he'd just bonded out of jail. The man was allegedly stabbed a white man. He was taking him back to his farm where he would work for free to pay off the bond. And in the car were his friends and relatives, George Dorsey, a World War II veteran, his wife, Roger Malcolm was the man who'd been bailed out. He was with his wife, Dorothy, and May Dorsey, who was George's wife, four of them. And they were stopped on a bridge at Moores Ford, very close to the town of Monroe, and they were led out. They were roped, the men were roped together, and they were taken near the banks of the river, and they were shot. And four people died like wildlife. Mm. Nobody should be terminated by this evil wildlife, like wildlife, being shot.
Well, this is just one of so many harrowing stories. Some of the charges, yeah, as spurious as walking behind a white woman, looking at a white woman, even worse. And you are working to seek grand jury transcripts from this case. Why do you want them, Anthony?
Well, we succeeded, my lawyer and I, in the federal district court in Macon, Georgia. The judge agreed that grand jury files could be disclosed, unsealed. And that would give me an insight into 16 days of testimony where the jury was rigged. Some of the jurors were related to the people giving evidence. The FBI said they were lying in a report to J. Edgar Hoover, the director. And I want to get to the bottom of this. I don't intend to solve it. I don't think I can solve it. But I want to show how evil it was, the rogue jury, the rigged juries, the vicious content of the rhetoric at the time. Eugene Talmadge was running for re-election as governor, and he said things that would be totally, totally unacceptable today, but they were acceptable at that time. He spoke openly, using the N-word, denouncing people, degrading them because of their color, and he was elected. And this had an effect, in my opinion, on the people who carried out this lynching. They were followers of his, and they didn't care about the FBI prosecuting them. They said, this is a local issue, it had nothing to do with you, go back home. So they didn't get much evidence from them in the 2,700-plus interviews. The African-Americans who were interviewed were terrified that they would end up exactly like the four victims who were shot to death. And so the FBI have been reviled here because it was said that they didn't do their job properly. They bust a gut. They really worked their butts off. I had access to 10,000 approximate documents from the FBI and the National Archives when I wrote this book, The Last Mass Lynching in America. And they really worked, but they could not find jurisdiction. They could not connect a state official with what had happened in the lynching. If they had have done that, they would have had jurisdiction. And that's why the federal government was forced to withdraw from the case. The Georgia Bureau of...
This also made a big impact in the federal government, a huge outcry about this, catalyzed large protests in Washington, D.C., New York City. President Truman created the President's Committee on Civil Rights after that. This, again, just four cases out of hundreds. Catherine, how are these victims of those killed in 1946 are going to be memorialized on Friday?
Well, these folks will be in the list of folks. We have a large piece of granite that will have four bronze plates on each one on each side, and all of the names of all of the victims will be on those plates, as well as a notation for those who are unknown, because we know that the fact that we've named 600 does not represent all of the people who were actually killed.
Catherine Meeks from Epsilon Jones Center for Racial Healing, also with us, the author and historian Anthony Pitch. Catherine, when that museum opened in Montgomery, Alabama, some critics said it's time to let these terrible crimes that belong in the past go. What's your response to that?
Well, I think when people say things like that, they don't quite understand the fact that history doesn't go away just because you want it to go away, and that you have to acknowledge what happened as you try to build a new narrative of a narrative of liberation. You have to pay attention to all of the pieces of history. And there's a definite intersection between slavery, lynching, the death penalty, mass incarceration, and 21st century police killings. And so to try to jump over lynching just means that you leave out one of those links of intersection, and it makes any work that you do not have a sustainable foundation. So I think that we have to remember, and we have to make atonements, and we have to say that this isn't ever going to be the way we live again. But we can't say that unless we really pay attention and own how we did live.
Well, for you, Anthony, you said you won't win this case. Obviously, the case has already happened, and justice is nearly impossible for families given that in many cases, the murderers themselves are long dead. So what is this? What does your excavation of these kind of cases do?
It's important to write about history, warts and all. This is part of American history, a vile chapter, but it has to be recorded as it happened. And to neglect it is to defy the message of history, which is to remember, because those who do not remember are condemned to repeat it, as it's often been said.
Anthony, why did this particular case get so much attention compared to other cases that have been happening for, 50, 60 years?
because there were four victims, and I went for it because one of the victims had survived World War II in service in North Africa and Australia, only to be gunned down by a rogue vigilante justice. It horrified me, and I have to get to the bottom of this and find out why these people have to be remembered. There is a marker, incidentally, near there where it happened. It was put up by the Morsford Memorial Committee, and it does have a very big error. It says that Dorothy Malcolm, the wife of the one of those who was killed, she was also killed, was 7 months pregnant, and a fetus was torn out of her belly. This is denied. This was not mentioned by the black undertaker who carried out the autopsies in the presence of an FBI investigator. Nobody mentioned it. The NAACP did not mention it. They were on top of this from the very beginning. A delegation from the Association of Colored Women, they met with the Assistant Attorney General. They never mentioned it. It never happened. And it's a really wicked intrusion on the truth.
Is part of your goal to correct the record?
Yes. Yeah. That one I have corrected in my book, but unfortunately it's gained currency in the internet. It is not true. And the man who's propagating this in the annual reenactment, I asked him, where did you get it from? He said, the undertaker told me. Well, if the undertaker had seen anything like this, you bet your bottom dollar he would have referred to it. You cannot cover up an atrocity like that.
Well, there are so many cases where that kind of thing did happen. I think it's probably easy for people to believe. And of course, you know, this is during the Great Migration of the early 20th century, a wave of African-American Southerners moved north, went to escape segregation and Jim Crow laws. Catherine, how well known were these kinds of stories and these kind of horrific things that Anthony is talking about happening? And how well communicated were they within the black community?
They were very well known and very well communicated, and they served their purpose of terrorizing people, because that's really what lynching was about, to terrorize people and to have black people not think they had any chance to live a life of being a true human being. And that's part of the reason why people were migrating, because they were being terrorized and they were trying to go someplace where they thought there would be some chance of life not being that detrimental to them. So they were very well known. And, you know, and it continues to be true that white supremacists who think that the best way to control is to terrorize people. So we still have terrorizing going on.
Well, and there were, of course, postcards sold with photographs of these lynchings, souvenirs, pieces of people actually murdered. Not entirely unlikely that a relative of a person living in Georgia today could have been there. So in this memorializing, Catherine, you said it's about racial healing. What role does that kind of reckoning play?
Well, I think the first step to healing is to name what has wounded you. And I think that white people don't understand that lynching wounded them as much as it wounded the black people. You cannot have these acts of terror with people coming out with their picnic lunches and celebrating as if it's a carnival and not have the community be wounded. So one of the things that we're doing is offering an opportunity for everybody who participates to say, this was a horrible thing. We stand against it. We call these people's names. We say we're sorry, and we want to build a better world. So there's a chance for all of us to engage in some healing by being together and acknowledging what happened and why it happened, and then reasserting our commitment to making the world a place where that kind of thing does not happen.
Last summer, three African-American senators introduced a bill to make lynching a crime. Now, this was not the first time Congress has tried to distinguish the crime from other murder laws. I was a little shocked to know that that hadn't happened. How is it that they haven't passed?
Well, you know, it is hard to believe that in 2018 that conversation is being had. I mean, why would we? Lynching is an extrajudicial killing, but we have police officers doing that to people now. If you shoot somebody down in the street without a trial, that's an extrajudicial killing. And so it just speaks to our place in the country where we have just not come to terms with that there's some behaviors that are totally unacceptable and we need to do something about it. And the fact that we are holding on to lynching as still a possibility that we have to talk about making it illegal. I mean, honestly, it just is mind-boggling to think that in 2018 that conversation is having to be had.
So how do you think victims' families move forward or find closure on such a horrible thing?
Well, it's like any kind of trauma. You know, sooner or later, you have to acknowledge it. You have to be enraged. You have to grieve. And then you have to make up your mind if you're going to die too or if you're going to put one foot in front of the other and move forward. And I think by coming together, doing these kinds of activities, like the November 2nd event that we're doing, helps people to know that there are other people standing in solidarity with them and that they can move forward. Because you do have to move on, or else you just have allowed the lynchers and those who would do horrible things, you've allowed them to win.
Catherine Meeks from Absalon Jones Center for Racial Healing and author and historian Anthony Pitch. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.